I don't know if this has ever happened to you. I shared this story with a few people. I'm not sure, because I think that's what begins to happen. Some of you may have more experience with this or not than I do, and that's where you forget things. Yeah, exactly. So I'm not sure if I've shared this with the entire congregation or not. I know I've shared it with a couple of small groups of folks, but I'm just curious if you've ever had anything like this happen to you. A few weeks back, I was in Royal Farms, and don't know how you feel, but I like Royal Farms chicken, man. Right? You know, there's a lot of different things, but I like Royal Farms chicken. And so I was in Royal Farms, and you know the process. You know how it works, right? You go over to the counter, you got the screen, got to do your thing, right? And then you get a receipt from that, but then you have to carry that over to the register, ring it up, right? And then you go back and wait for your chicken. And so I typed in my order, got my slip, really didn't pay much of attention to it, just got it, headed over to the register. I was paying for that, and I think I picked up a soda or something. I was paying for that at the register, and I saw that the guy behind the register was kind of like, I didn't think anything about it. I was just like, I don't know, maybe he doesn't like Coke or something. I don't know. And anyway, I got it. So as I was walking back toward the chicken counter, I looked down, and I was like, really? And I saw my order number, and I thought, okay, let's see. Should I do anything about this or just roll with it, you know? It was just kind of one of those days anyway, and I was thinking, man. So I'm standing there, and of course some other people were standing around. You know how it is. Everybody's waiting on the chicken around the chicken counter. And the lady, the order comes up, and so she begins to read out the order. You know how they yell out your number. And she looks down. I could tell she was hesitating for a second, and she goes, order 666. And, you know, it was one of those things where all of a sudden there was these gasps. And literally, I mean, like literally, I'm standing back, you know. I don't know. They got that, you know, where the island is where the registers are, and then there's other stuff. So I'm kind of standing back here and 666. You know, and literally, I mean, there's like... And one woman, she turns to her neighbor. She goes, I wouldn't get that chicken. And I was like, really? And I thought, okay, so maybe, you know, because I had some other people when I told them this story. They said, well, did you tell them you were a pastor? And I was like, well, that wouldn't help things. That would make it worse. Right? And I thought, so I just went up there, gave him the thing, and even the guy, the young guy behind the counter goes, man, I don't know, dude, I'd say a prayer or something before you get out of the parking lot. And I came home, I was going to save the receipt, you know, because I thought, I can use this at a later time. You know, this would be a good prop or something. And Laura Lee wouldn't let me keep it, man. She threw it away. She was like... No, I said, but check it out. I don't know if you've ever had that happen to you. I don't know if you've ever had something and where that landed those numbers, and then you're like, right? There's something about that. I mean, to me, what was interesting is most likely, the folks that were reacting to that number sitting in or standing in that Royal Farms that day, probably most of them, and I'm not trying to judge them, I'm just saying statistically, probably they were biblically illiterate, right? I mean, you don't have to know the Bible to have heard of 666. You don't, I mean, there are rock bands. There's all kinds of stuff. You know what I mean? That can show up all over the place, right? I mean, good lands, you know. I mean, before I was walking through, you know, walking with Christ, I mean, I grew up in church, so I'd heard that somewhere along the line, right? I remember when Laura Lee and I first met, right? You can use this to mess with her, but I met her birthday, and I looked at her license. I went, 626-66, holy crap. That's what I said. I was like, man, you got like only one digit. It's not a six. That's bad, you know? And, you know, there are things we think, I thought, the person who gasps, the guy behind the counter who says, say a prayer, I was thinking, do they really, you know, are we just reacting to that, or do they really even have an understanding of what that is about, you know? And I wasn't really in the mood to tell them about it at that moment. I was just kind of like, let me get my chicken and get out of here. You know, because I figured then everybody's going to be watching me out the door. There goes that guy, you know, waiting for me to have an accident at the intersection or something. See, I told you. See? But anyway, today we're peering into chapter 13 as we land in Revelation for the 10th week. And again, this is something we're going to roll in through. I'll be giving you guys a break in a few weeks. We'll take a break 1 week from this. But we're going to walk through this till we get to the end of Revelation. And last Sunday we were in chapter 12, which is considered the heart of this vision. And again, I've been trying to kind of share with you guys along the way some of the challenges and navigational hazards. But I talked about how, you know, unlike a lot of other genres in the Bible, this isn't an epistle, this isn't a letter, this isn't a gospel or narrative or basically a biography. This isn't like Genesis and some of those other books that are Old Testament narratives, which are stories with, you know, people, places, and things so much. But the bulk of Revelation, it's a vision, right? And so you need to make sure you don't forget that this is in a vision. And so that's a little bit harder sometimes to navigate and understand what's going on. It's interpreting a vision, which is like interpreting a dream, right? And some of you have tried to interpret your own dreams and didn't do too well, right? I mean, I don't know about you, if you've got a spouse, you've got somebody and they tell you a dream and go, what do you think that means? And you just kind of go, I don't think you're crazy. That's what I think that means, right? Or, you know, I mean, so now we're trying to interpret a dream or a vision from someone, the Apostle John, who was given this vision and dream by Christ, for Christ, and to kind of unfold God's plan. And some of that had immediate consequences, and some of it had consequences yet to be experienced. But anyway, last week, the heart of the vision was this battle, right? And this epic battle between good and evil, the war that took place in heaven. And it also talked about Satan's inability, he wanted to, but he was unable to take out the Messiah, right? And the Messiah was born, the Messiah lived, the Messiah was crucified, dead, buried, but then ascended to his heavenly throne. And Satan was unable to stop that. So, because he's defeated, the dragon, as he was talked about, or as he was utilized in Revelation 12, he's now set his sights. He couldn't defeat the Messiah. He couldn't defeat Michael and the guys in heaven in the battle. He couldn't defeat the Messiah, Christ, here on earth. He's a defeated foe. But now he set his sights on you and I. He set his sights on the believers, on God's people. And chapter 13, where we're going to be at today, kind of unfolds the strategy with which he wages that warfare, okay? It gives us a little insight into how he wages his warfare against us. But before we get into it, you know what's coming, right? Got a couple questions. Yeah, come to church and think. We like it. All right, now, some of these questions, if you haven't already thought this, there could have been times when I've asked you questions and you thought, I think he's losing it. I don't know if you've thought that yet, you know, or if the questions have still seemed to be rational to you or sane. We'll see as we get further into this. So here are my questions for you today. Ready? What sensational, supernatural sign, but I'm not going to say you. Why? Because we're in this together, right? What sensational, supernatural sign are we waiting for to cement our belief? Think about that. You never had those conversations. You never overheard those conversations. You never been in the presence of those conversations or participated in those conversations. You've never made a request. Lord, if you just give me a sign. What sensational supernatural sign are we waiting for to cement our belief? That's the easy one. Ready for the next question? Have we already embraced or received the mark of the beast? That'll get your attention a little bit. Have we already embraced or even possibly received the mark of the beast? You better think about it. So, with those two questions, laying it down, let's get into the text. So open it up. You can open up your Bibles. It'll be on the screen. It's in your programs. Revelation chapter 13, verses 1 and 2. Okay, so this is after the battle, after Satan has been thrown down from heaven to earth, after he has been defeated. It closes out in chapter 12 that he's now standing by the shore of the sea. Right? Cast down to earth, kicked out of heaven, he and a third of the angels from heaven. And then this is what it says. John, receiving this vision, then I saw a beast rising up out of the sea. It had seven heads and 10 horns with 10 crowns on its horns. And written on each head were names that blasphemed God. This beast looked like a leopard, but it had the feet of a bear and the mouth of a lion. How's your imagination? Are you pulling this together? And the dragon, last week, Satan, dragon, standing by the shore, watching the beast come out of the sea. The dragon gave the beast his own power and throne and great authority. So, first this beast, kind of odd looking deal, right? I mean, this beast comes up out of the sea. Right, we got seven heads, 10 horns. That's already kind of messed up, right? And then it looks like, well, we got leopard, we got bear, we got lion. I mean, this is a pretty messed up sight. It can be pretty intimidating, pretty scary. And of course, like I said before, you know, let's not get so enamored with the details that we miss the message, because some of you that have been around this before, you've heard all the different things, and guys speculate, right? And that's what we do more with Revelation than anything. We speculate, okay? And so people say, oh, well, we know what that is. See, here's what usually say, oh, well, see the seven horns, these 10 heads and all that. You know what that represents? That represents, what have you heard? Ah, countries, powers, empires, right? Well, I can tell you what the first people that heard it thought. And that's what we can't forget. We got to remember who was the first recipients of this letter, that it contained this vision. And remember back at the beginning of this deal was seven churches in Turkey. Seven churches in Turkey, real people, real places, we're receiving this vision, okay? So that's about the only concrete thing we've got in this is the people who are receiving it. People who would have been steeped in the Old Testament, because that would have been their Bible. They didn't have this, right? They were just getting this letter, and somebody was going to stand up and read this thing to them all at once. You've been getting it chunk by chunk. Can you imagine if you sat down, somebody read this whole thing to you, and then went, so what do you think? You'd be like, man, you know, again, who's on acid? Somebody's, you know, something's going on. And it's like, whoa. So, but here's what would have come to their minds because of their context. They would immediately, anything that kept referring to seven, yes, there's the idea of the number of completion and people get lost in all the number stuff, right? But that's a very real possibility. But they would have thought right away, those people would have thought right away early in the first century, Rome. Rome was a city with seven hills. It was known as the city on seven hills. I mean, that was literally a theme, something that was stated all the time. When it was referred to Rome, this Roman Empire, a city with seven hills. So a lot of those folks, in their minds, as soon as they heard something about something having power, having, you know, Horns, horns were a symbol of power. Seven horns or seven hills Rome. And they would have thought, oh man, ten. Maybe that's speaking of different emperors of Rome. Because that's who they were dealing with. Right? We soon come up with all kinds of other names. But we got to understand who was receiving this first. And in their context, as they're trying to interpret it and figure it out, they're going, okay, that must be Rome. See, now you and I sit and we hear, of course, because we got all the books and the movies and all that stuff now, right? Because all of them are 100% right. You know, and so we're like, well, we know what that is. You know what that record, we even tell people, we'll act pretty confident when we say it. Well, that represents the European Union. You do know that, right? That's the EU. I mean, we've heard it. That's what we've been told, right? And we could, even if we wanted to right now, with Britain bailing out of the EU, we could say, oh, well, this is where it says where one of the heads is going to be wounded. This is going to cause... right? But if you talked to the Jewish believers in Turkey and you had said that, they'd have been like, who's the EU? What are you talking about? You know, that's Rome. There was an immediate consequence. There was also things to come. You got to understand, in their context, all of a sudden, there was also 7 years that they had dealt with where there had been extreme persecution. 7 years. Right? From AD 63 to AD 70, when the temple was destroyed, for 7 years, there was havoc wreaked on them. The emperors began to persecute the Christians systematically. So a lot of these things to them sounded like what they were experiencing right then, or even had seen, you know, experienced in the very recent past. I only say that to caution us before we think we've got the conclusion because somebody's got a really nice chart somewhere. So, early Christians kind of leaned toward Roman emperors. See, there was a guy, and it talks about the blaspheme, you know, and here's kind of the thing. Seven hills represented Rome to a lot of them. Ten, they would have speculated a little bit about. Maybe that's emperors. But it would say on each one of these heads, it had a name, and the name was a blasphemy of God. And see, that was one of the things when you said something like that, that would have been like rang in their ears of these emperors they were dealing with. Domitian was one of the emperors, and he required everyone to call him Lord and God. See, you got to, don't forget what was going on. Emperor worship was a huge deal. These guys weren't just leaders. They were to be worshiped as gods. And he wanted to be called, he wanted to be referred to, right? Not your honor, your excellency. He wanted to be referred to as Lord and God. So that would have rang in their ears. Ooh, that sounds like some of that stuff going on. Then there was a guy named Nero. You ever heard of Nero? Right? Nero was the first emperor to actually systematically begin persecuting the Christians. Right? Others had done little things, but I mean, this guy literally set out a plan to, I'm going to wipe them out. I'm going to do all kinds of crazy stuff. But anyway, this first beast that rises up, we'll call it a world power, because I do believe there is a connection to that world power, but I think the early Christians would have thought of it as Rome. But there are other things connected with it, so you and I, thousands of years later, we look back and go, well, that can't be Rome, unless, oh, I know what power is going to rise up. It's coming from Rome. Rome, what's in Rome? Who has power in Rome? I knew the evil Catholic Church was going to rise up and be the beast out of the sea. Right, I'm just telling you, man, there's people that come with all kinds of different directions, right? But we know that there's going to be some kind of a world power that's going to rise up symbolized in this beast. And he's going to be able to wage war against God's people, but he's going to rule the nations. So this war being raised against God's people, but ruling the nations that talked about in Scripture, does suggest world power. Wouldn't argue against that. Interesting that he's been granted authority for 42 months. How many days is that? 1,260 days. Or it could also be called what? 3.5 years or times, times, and half a time, right? Because this is like the Bible wants to make sure that we get it, so it's very redundant. All right? So we hear 42 months, 1,260 days, 3.5 years, times, times, and half a time. right? And I don't know if they were doing that because they knew that they couldn't make change at the local restaurant or something, like, half a time. Just think about it, right? They're going to try to get them to think. But over and over again. So, again, I'll just tell you, something to consider. Seven talked about in divinity. But when it comes to talking about phases of time in Revelation, remember I talked about Revelation is not just chronological. You don't flip the page and that's the next day. I gave you a word last week for you to look up and learn. I don't know if you did. An excursus. An excursus is a digression. See, so what happens a lot of times in Revelation, you'll be reading along and go, and then woo, it'll jump back and show you something else that was going on in the same time period. Oh, well, let's go back and take a deeper look. And we think it's like way down here. That's why I told you, Revelation, man, it's like we've gone on the other side of the looking glass. We were on the other side of the looking glass. We've gone down the rabbit hole, right? All the rules of normal time do not apply inside the vision. But it seems interesting to me that 1,260 days, 3.5 years, 42 months, or times, and half a times is mentioned more than 7 years is when it comes to tribulation or comes to time frames pertaining to God's people, either being protected or being tormented. Just something to think about. All right, but there's a strategy in here, and that's what I want you to get. Instead of all of these details, there's something I want you to see or understand with this first beast. This first beast wages war on God's people, right, but rules the nation. And this is one of the enemy's strategy. It was then, it is now, and it will be. And one of the enemy's strategy is intimidation. Power. To intimidate us. To frighten God's people into disobedience. To frighten God's people into disobedience. Have you ever been intimidated before? I mean, have you ever been sitting somewhere and you felt like somebody was having a conversation and you felt like God nudged you and you're supposed to say something, share your faith, or you're supposed to say something about God, but because of who it is or the situation or where you're at, you felt a little scared, you were intimidated, and you didn't do it. That's just a real small example. We've probably all been there, right? Multiple times. Well, think about it. I mean, are we being intimidated even today? Continue on. Revelation chapter 13. Verse 8 says, and all the people who belong to this world worshiped the beast. Still talking about the first beast, right? Coming out of the sea. All the people who belong to this world worship the beast. They are the ones. Now here comes a really kind of tricky, crazy thing. And you think we did a typo, but we put it in here twice on purpose. And all the people who belong to this world worship the beast. They are the ones whose names were not written in the book of life before the world was made, the book that belongs to the Lamb who was slaughtered. Now, we've heard about the book before, right? The Lamb's book of life. We talked about that even last year, right? And it comes up a lot of times in Scripture, the Lamb's book of life. Those who have their name written in this book are those that will experience eternal life. Those that don't make it into the book or don't have their names in the book will not experience eternal life. And we read this here and we go, oh, okay, well, let's see. People who belong to worship beasts. Oh, the only people that are going to worship the beasts are the ones that, who do not have their name written in the book of life, the book of life before the world was made. So that would tell me that all of these names were written in that book before time ever started. Right? And that's how it's rendered in some manuscripts. But let's look at it how it's rendered in other manuscripts. So Revelation chapter 13, verse 8 again. Have we got another one? Do we have both of these verses in there? What's that? Okay, that's all right. Yeah, it was purposely put in there in both of these because I wanted you to see that it is not rendered the same in all manuscripts. Okay, that was the New Living Translation. It says, they are the ones whose names were not written in the book of life before the world was made, which suggests to you and I that all the names are placed in the book before the world ever began. And that massages some people's theology. That's good. The problem with that is there are other translations and other manuscripts that render it and go, well, wait a minute. That's not really a better translation. The better rendering is this. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast. all whose names have not been written in the book of life, belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. Okay, wait a minute. That changes things. Now we're not talking about people's names being written in the book before the beginning of time. We're talking about from the beginning of creation, a lamb that was already destined to be slain to redeem mankind. So it's amazing. This is a difficulty. And I could have just like glossed over this so that you all wouldn't be confused. And then some people want to throw out the baby with the bathwater and say, oh, who can understand all this? Blah, blah, blah. Look, there are thousands of verses in the Bible that there is absolutely no problem with. You can understand them 100% completely. They say what they say. But there are also challenges every now and then you come across. And when they're trying to translate stuff, especially when you're dealing with a language that doesn't have consonants. Or, I mean, doesn't have vowels. Sorry about that. Did you know that? Did you know that? Hebrew? There's no vowels. Not in the ancient written Hebrew. So as you're translating things, you're looking at all the consonants, and you got to go by the context to try to figure out what the translation is. Then let's add to, did you know they didn't have punctuation? Oh, that really helps, right? So there's a lot of things that can become challenging. The order of words. So when people are translating, you know, there's all kinds of people that want to do the whole evil translation thing. They're evil translations. There's only one, King James. That's absolute crap from A to Z. That is A to Z crap. Okay? The only good translation are the Greek and Hebrew. Right? And if you can't argue about that, then shut up. When we try to use our language as the basis for measuring anything, we've already stepped into error. Because it wasn't written in English. Right? So when somebody asks me, what's the best translation? I say, which verse? Because it comes down to that. Which verse? Because some translations do an incredible job with 5,000 of them, but kind of screw up 100 of them. And then this translation does great with another 1,000, but it's just, that's the dynamic, folks. Translation is not easy. You try to translate something from Spanish to English, right? It's just not an easy process. And so I just wanted to show you an example of how sometimes we can roll in and go, oh, see, that's exactly what I thought it meant. That's why I believe this. So you got one, two ways you can roll. You can say, okay, well, all the names were written in the book before it ever started. So it's already set up. I have nothing in it. Or we can find out that God's plan from the very beginning of creation in the fall, he'd already set forth his creation to redeem the planet and redeem mankind through his son. And those that accept that get their names written in the book. Did you know there's a place in the Bible where it talks about having your name erased from the book of life? That'll mess up some stuff. But we're not there right now, so they're not going to go over that. This was extra stuff, right? This was extra stuff, so somebody will say, thanks a lot. So anyway, I'm just wanting you to know that the side note here is demonstrate that on some occasions there can be difficult passages to interpret simply because of word order, lack of punctuation, those kind of things. But here's what we can count on regardless. One point is clear. Those who are not in the book worship the beast. See, that's kind of like don't miss the message by getting enamored with the detail. Whether the book was before eternity or God's plan was for Christ to lay down his life at creation and fall, the bottom line is those that name their name in the book are going to worship the beast. That's the bottom line. So going on, verse 9 and 10, chapter 13. Anyone with ears to hear should listen and understand. Wow, that comes up. Somebody used to say that all the time. Wow, Jesus used to say that a lot, didn't he? He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Right? Anyone with ears to hear should listen and understand. And then he actually, in verse 10, doesn't show up in here, but verse 10 is actually a quote. Verse 10, he's quoting Jeremiah chapter 15:2. Again, folks, you got to remember, their Bible was the Old Testament. They knew the Old Testament inside and out. That would be what they were referencing. And so when all of a sudden John comes out and he says this, he's actually quoting Jeremiah 15, 2, but he kind of misquotes it on purpose. Anyone with ears to hear should listen and understand. Anyone who is destined for prison will be taken to prison. Anyone destined to die by the sword will die by the sword. Now that's this rendering. And then it has this really powerful sentence that we need to get a hold of. This means, so when there's an explanation offered in the scripture, that's helpful. This means that God's holy people must endure persecution patiently and remain faithful. Wait a minute. I'm not getting in line for that. That's not what the TBN guy said. Right? I mean, he said, I just got to mail this stuff in, send it in. They're going to bless it. I'm going to get a Cadillac. I'm going to get all kinds of money. And God doesn't want me to be anything but happy, happy, happy all the time, dance and sing. Right? That sounds great until you open up the Bible. And then that screws all that up. Because then you're like, well, okay, these guys were a whole lot more faithful than I am. And they didn't get that plan. Right? So all of a sudden, here's this thing thrown in that says God's holy people must endure, and remain faithful. Well, to the guys who were getting this the first time, that would have made sense to them. They knew what they were going through right then and there. They were suffering persecution. They were watching the church suffer persecution. People who were their friends and family they loved were being persecuted because of their faith. So they understood we got a hold, like I talked about last week. We got to remain patient and endure. Who wants to suffer? Anybody? Yeah, you're not crazy, right? Not that you're going to declare publicly here, but I don't think any of us, I don't know that there's anybody that goes, oh man, I've been looking forward to this pain. This is awesome, right? I don't think so. None of us want to endure. Do you know there are people right now, the numbers are being crunched, and of course with the onset of ISIS, it's really dramatically increased. But even before the rise of ISIS, do you know that it was speculated, and I'm not talking about just speculation, I'm talking about people trying to actually calculate. It's speculated that over 100,000 people every year are martyred for their faith around the world. Think about that. 100,000 people around the world, globally speaking, are killed because of their declaration of their faith in Jesus Christ or their unwillingness to deny him. And the best we got is, oh my God, how long have we got to clap? I'm sorry, God inconvenienced you this morning. Pathetic is what it is. I don't know that we have any American Christians that are really actually have what it takes to lay down their life for their faith. Good grief. Suffering? We don't like inconvenience. Right? I think we'll all get the opportunity to see. Anyway, Revelation 13, 11 and 12 says this. Then I saw another beast. Oh no, not just one, now there's another one. Another beast, but this one doesn't come out of the sea, it comes out of the earth. Then another beast came up out of the earth. He had two horns like those of a lamb. But he spoke with the voice of a dragon. He exercised all the authority of the first beast. So they're tied together. And he required all the earth and its people to worship the first beast, whose fatal wound had been healed, right? And that's in some of the other verses that I'm not reading, but you're going to read because that's why I left them out. So you have to read them in case I might be lying to you, right? All right, so there's this fatal thing. See, this second beast comes up. This first beast is some kind of a world power, and intimidation is the strategy. But this second beast, who's directly connected to the first beast, comes up out of the land, but he looks like a lamb. Right? Looks like a lamb. Might even look like the lamb. But he sounds like a dragon. Folks, that's a counterfeit. Something that's going to appear or look like a lamb, but it's going to speak and it's going to be the dragon. That's a counterfeit. But here's going to be the thing about this counterfeit. This counterfeit that's going to look like a lamb but speaks like a dragon and is granted authority just like the first beast and is going to be in partnership or in cahoots with this first beast. It's going to require all the inhabitants of the world to worship this first beast. You think, well, that's not going to work. Nobody can force us to worship anything. Right? I don't know. I think sometimes we've been lulled to sleep and we don't even know it. I think we've been led, I think our economy, our culture, the society, the world we lived in is caused us to worship money and we don't realize it. Oh, it doesn't have any effect. It doesn't affect your choices, your decisions. I think it does. And then we have mass marketing that helps like even push it even more. Well, you got to have this. You know, you got to have this. You got to keep up with them. And you know, you got to have this. Or you're not very, you know, if don't drive that. If you drive this, it means you're something. I mean, look, that's just our culture, our society, right? Anyway, something to think about. But this second beast who looks like a lamb but speaks like a dragon, this counterfeit, here's going to be the crazy thing. This second beast is given the ability to perform incredible miracles. Sensational, supernatural signs. And those of you that are waiting for your sign are going to get it, and you're going to be duped because you're basing your faith on signs. And that's what the enemy knows. All I got to do is make something sensational. Throw in a little supernatural and some signs, and they will drop on their knees so quick and worship the beast. It will be fascinating to see. Of course, he says he'll require all to worship the beast. It's a nice way of saying if you don't, you'll be killed. All right? I mean, this isn't like the first time this has ever happened. I mean, everybody that would have been reading this the first time, they remember the stories. They would have thought about not just the emperors. They would have thought back in their past and go, you know, I remember the story of these four Jewish boys. This really powerful king. He told them they had to bow down and worship him, worship his statue. And if they didn't do it, he was going to throw them in the fire. Y'all remember that story? They chose not to. And they got thrown in the fire. However, God saw them through and brought them out of the fire. Right? The strategy of the second beast, this twofold strategy the enemy has against God's people. The first one with the first beast is intimidation. The second beast is deception. To deceive. All these miracles and signs and wonders. Right? And people will just like, oh. Folks, you and I need to learn to discern, to be able to distinguish, to make judgment on what's real or what's not or what's counterfeit. And don't base that on gifts. Gifts are like the worst measuring tool. You want to measure something? You measure the message because the message better line up with God's word. And you measure the fruit of that person's life or that ministry's life. The fruit, not the gifts, because the gifts are sensational and the gifts do all that. Man, what is the fruit of it? Right? What's the character of it? What is the message? If the message isn't lining up with this, I don't care how shiny it looks. Verses 16 through 18. He, this is the second beast, required everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave to be, given a mark on the right hand and on the forehead. Right? This is why we're all getting nervous about the chips in our cards, and now they got chips in our animals, and we're thinking, I know it, I know it. They're gonna put a chip in our forehead, they're gonna put a chip in my hand, I know what's going on. Then I gotta go to Target and go, doop, right? Sorry, you're not worried about the bathroom there. Don't be worried about the chip. Sorry, that was free. And no one could buy or sell anything without that mark, which was either the name of the beast or the number representing his name. And I love this. You should underline this a lot. Highlight it. Verse 18 starts out, wisdom is needed here. Wisdom is needed here. It's like the vision that's given to John as John's writing it down. He's like, okay, wait a minute. I better put something here. Hey, listen up. Wisdom is needed here. I know I just dropped a bomb on you. You guys are going to run to the races. Wisdom is needed here. Let the one with understanding solve the meaning of the number of the beast. For it is the number of a man. His number is 666. Or as in the manuscripts, because in Hebrew, they didn't have a numbering system, written numbering system. They wrote out the numbers, like they spelled out the numbers. 6, like on your check, 166. That's how it was written out. Okay? 666. This mark will indicate a person's allegiance. Allegiance to the Antichrist. That would be the one who is a counterfeit Christ, right? But I think it's more than that. I think it's a lot of things connected to that. Did you know that in some manuscripts, it doesn't say 666? Some manuscripts, it says 616, 616. That would like mess up some bands and stuff. That would be like a lot of things you couldn't do this. Oh, 616. Dang on it. Yeah, we're off. Right? 616. 666, 616. I think it's a mockery, honestly. It's a mockery of the seal. Remember back in Revelation chapter 7 where we're talking about where God placed a seal? He said, hold up before you start pouring out all the judgments and everything. I want you to go around. I want you to place a seal on my people. Right? It wasn't embedding a chip. It wasn't smacking. It was God's supernatural seal, something that may not even be visible to you or I, but it was his seal on those who were his, those who were faithful. And so in an effort to counterfeit, the beast is going to say, we're going to place a seal on all those who swear their allegiance to the Antichrist or the beast. And those who were reading this for the first time, man, that would have jumped out at them. That would have made a lot of sense for them. And guess what? They wouldn't have taken it quite as literally as we do today. That's what would surprise you. See, if you go back, the whole idea of something on your forehead and your hand, man, that's a deep biblical imagery that's used repeatedly. Deuteronomy, Exodus, right? If you look up, you can write this down if anybody wants to check on us. Exodus chapter 13, look at verses 9 and 16, and then just look at Deuteronomy 6:8. That is mentioned again and again and again. So when they had heard this the first time, you know what they would immediately would have thought? Oh, yeah, we know what that's saying. Because when God gave us the calendar of all these feasts, when God told us about the commandments, he said that we were to bind them. We were to bind them on our right hand and our forehead. And see, the Jews got like really literal later, right? And then they started making what you guys ever heard of phylactery? Phylactery, right? I don't know, I mean, if you've ever been around Orthodox Jews, okay? If you've ever been around Hasidic Jews or Orthodox Jews, or you'll see they'll have a box, looks like a box. They'll have tied on their forehead, right? Looks like a little box inside of the box. And then a lot of them, you'll see them, they'll have something wrapped around their arm, and there'll be like another box here. See, God was telling them that these commandments that I've given you, the way that I've instructed you to live, you are to bind them on your hands and on your forehead. What that meant when God gave it to them originally was that your actions and your beliefs should reflect your allegiance to me. That's what that was all about. Teach your kids these commandments. Put it on the doorpost of your home. That originally meant, it's meant not only should you daily, everywhere you go, reflect by your actions and by your beliefs that you are allegiant, your allegiance is to God, it's also your household should reflect that. Oh, so you're not just a Christian when you come to this building. I thought my home was my sanctuary. Well, what do you mean by that? A place where you can go and act stupid? I mean, our home, you know, what is a sanctuary? That's interesting, isn't it? Use a word. We come here to the sanctuary. Into the presence of God to worship. But the presence of God is supposed to be with us no matter where we're at. So even our sanctuary, our safe place. In other words, folks, there is no difference between sacred and secular. That's not supposed to happen. All things are sacred. Regardless of where you or I are at, regardless of who we're with, we're supposed to be the same person. A person whose actions and beliefs reflect our allegiance to God. That's what that's about. But it's interesting, this number has brought up a lot of stuff. Because even throughout history, and this whole branding, there were people, because did you know in between the Old Testament and the New Testament, a lot of Jews were branded with a symbol? They had to be branded with a symbol depending on who was in power. Making sure that they knew they were Jews. You guys remember the films, Nazi Germany. Some of you, you know, myself included, not old enough to remember it, but old enough to see the films, how they had to put the gold star on and all that, how they were being marked out, right? And the whole 666 thing, you would be amazed at the number of people who have been considered to be the Antichrist. It would shock you. Maybe it wouldn't shock you, but. I mean, there's some major contenders, and I get it. I mean, if you were living during the 40s, right? Who would have not thought that Hitler is the Antichrist? I mean, he's responsible for killing millions of people, right? And there are people that did the math and said, oh, yep, 666, that adds up to Hitler. What about before that, folks? You think Hitler was a bad guy? What about Stalin? 20 to 30 million people killed. Can we even conceive that number? Surely he was considered the Antichrist. Great candidate. There were people, I remember growing up, here's a crazy thing. This is church stuff too, church people. I have a whole book. I wish I could find this book somewhere. I got a book with Mikhail Gorbachev's picture on the front, declaring he is the Antichrist because of the birthmark he had on his forehead. Right? That was the mark of the beast. Right? Well, I don't know if you knew this. I got a birthmark right here between my eyes. When I get ticked off, it'll show up and you'll see it. And Laura Lee said, I think that's the mark of the beast. Right? 666. There are people that said Ronald Reagan was the Antichrist. Absolutely there were, because all three of his names, first, middle, and last name, all have six letters. 666. So they wrote an article, maybe a book. You think that's crazy? I know this is going to, you're going to think I'm messing with you right here. Barney was considered by some to be the Antichrist. There was an article written. Now, I can't argue that one, because that one, he got on my nerves after a while, too. So I was like, you know, he's like a Pied Piper trying to lull all our children. Nah, 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 and everybody just walks, you know, right? I don't know. A lot of stuff going on there. But most understand, again, this reference to the mark on the hand and the forehead is coming back to Exodus and going back to Deuteronomy. And again, who, with whom does our allegiance lie? With whom do our allegiance lie? The original believers, over and over again, they thought it was Nero. Because, again, because there wasn't a written numbers were written out and given, assessed a value. So then what ended up happening is the Jewish people took the Hebrew and they assigned a numerical value to each letter. And when you did that, and there's a whole process with people doing this, when you do that, if you were to add up the numerical value of Caesar Nero, it comes out to 666. And he was currently and had been persecuting them. So they would have thought, without a doubt, this is the Antichrist. But see, the Apostle John speaks about this even outside of Revelation. That's why I put the one scripture on the front of your program. And that's not the only place. John, in his literature, mentions this whole Antichrist thing over and over. Because he wants us to understand it is not just a person. Yes, there will be an Antichrist that is in place at the end of time, but there have been many antichrists who have come and served the evil empire, if you will, for years. See, here's the thing to think about. God is omnipresent. Satan is not. I don't know if you knew that. God can be everywhere. God can know everything, right? Satan can't. Satan can't even read your mind. But he can watch you, and he can observe your attitudes and your patterns and what you do, and boy, he can set you up really well, right? His time is running out. He knows that, but he doesn't know when. So he's got to have an antichrist in place all the time, ready to be the next one. Who's going to be the next person to serve in a capacity that their allegiance is going to be to the enemy and not God? The strategy of the enemy of God's people is twofold: intimidation and deception. So my question, you know, not the questions I asked you earlier, but, you know, will we as believers come out of the closet? Everyone else is. Right? Think about that. I'm not just saying that in jest. I mean it. Everybody else is coming out of the closet, standing up, willing to be heard, wanting to have their voices heard. And to be respected. Wow. What do we do? I don't want to talk about that. I mean, politics and religion, we don't want to talk about that kind of stuff. Will we be intimidated by our world and our enemy, and compromise our testimony by our actions? Wow, that's a boatload question right there, isn't it? Good grief. Will we be intimidated by the world and our enemy, and then compromise our testimony by our actions? Because I am telling you, intimidation and deception, you know what Satan loves to do? And man, he's doing it very effectively today. He wants to compromise us, to silence us. How many people know the truth but aren't living the truth, so they're not going to say anything about the truth? Wow. Hard for you to get up and loudly and boldly proclaim the truth when you know you're not even living it yourself. And boy, so Satan silences. It puts a muzzle on the church because the church is so compromised because there's more sexual immorality going on inside these walls than there is outside. Well, you didn't have to go there. I mean, that was not just this building. I'm saying that metaphor, all of it. I'm talking about the church. We got more immorality inside the church than there is outside of the church. And so we have effectively silenced ourselves because we ain't got nothing to say. We gonna tell somebody how to live? We're gonna declare what's right and what's wrong? We could. But can we? Remember this. Michael defeated the dragon in heaven. Christ defeated the dragon here on earth. He is a defeated bully. A defeated bully. I'm not saying underestimate your enemy. No, no. But don't overestimate your enemy. He is a defeated bully still trying to intimidate and deceive. Because his time is running out. So I return to the questions in closing. What sensational supernatural sign are we waiting for to cement our belief? And have we already And this is the question you thought I was crazy at the beginning of this. Have we already embraced or received the mark of the beast? Do our actions and our beliefs demonstrate that our allegiance is not to God? That's the mark of the beast. Let's pray.